Modern Love, the podcast, is supported by...
This podcast is supported by Cartier. In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, Cartier shares testaments of love in all its forms from around the world. Please keep listening for today's love story later in this episode.
From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love. Stories of love, loss, and redemption. I'm your host, Meghna Chakrabarty. When you're first dating someone, it can be easy to ignore the warning signs, to tell yourself that there might be potential in the relationship, when deep down, you know it's probably doomed. That's what Julie Klausner writes about in this week's essay. It's read by Sashir Zameida, who stars in the stand-up special Pizza Mind and hosts the podcast United States of Music. She reads Julie's essay, "Was I on a date or babysitting?"
A cute guy from a rock band sent me an email message out of the blue. We had a friend in common, and he saw me sing Christmas Wrapping by The Waitresses one night in Brooklyn at karaoke. He wanted to say hi, he wrote, but was unshaven at the time and didn't want to make a bad impression. So far, so good. He was certainly handsome, which I discovered thanks to Google. Lanky, thin, straw-colored hair, cheekbones so sharp they could shave slices like post-it notes off a block of Jarlsberg. He continued, in all lowercase, to introduce himself. I scrolled over his rambling exposition, waiting for the payoff. Was he going to ask me out? He didn't. I'm at home, absolutely spazzing out because we're leaving in a few days to make a record and I have to, slash really should, finish a long list of songs. So waving hello and or re-hello, all the bestest. My enthusiasm waned. A hot guy in an indie band waved me hello and or re-hello mid-spazz out? And he's leaving in a few days to make a rock album? How old is he? 40 going on 19? I rolled my eyes, but they only landed on those cheekbones on my computer screen. I wrote back and made it easy for him. I even used all lowercase, mirroring his casualness. Hi. Let me know if you ever want to get a drink sometime. It would be fun to meet up. A relationship book I once read told women to use the word fun whenever possible. The author claimed it had a subliminal, aphrodisiac effect on men who want a relaxed girl, attached only to good times. The human equivalent of Diet Coke. This is not me. Over the next month, I got a few texts from him, reporting on his band's stay in the Northwest. Updates on their album, the weather. His texts were postcards. He was broadcasting, not communicating. Even so, I liked hearing from him and wondered if he would meet up with me in New York, or if he would flake out. Despite my skepticism, I still wanted to go on a date with a good-looking guy who went through the trouble of getting in touch with me after seeing me sing in a bar. While he was away, I asked my musician friends what they knew about him. Joanna, a singer, summed him up. He's an indie rock dreamboat. His voice is transcendent, and he writes lovely lyrics. He has a nice face, he has a kid, and he tours a lot. He's a star in his world. I was surprised to hear he was a father. I was 28 then and had never dated a guy with a child. Also, he seemed like sort of a kid himself. I have never been one for musicians. I know girls are supposed to go crazy for frontmen who close their eyes when they sing and nod their heads when the drums kick in, but I'll take wit and brains over the ability to carry a tune any day. You can teach a monkey to play the guitar, you know. Still, anyone who can make a living doing something creative is impressive. And he did have a nice face. I would have to take Joanna's word for it about his lyrics, though, because I tried to listen to a couple of his songs online and was too bored by the melodies to pay attention to the words. It was typical emo stuff. Drony, thick, exhausting, but obviously heartfelt. He sent a text message when he was back in town and asked me out for Monday. I said yes, and he wrote, "Actually, are you around tonight?" "No," I wrote. I felt like a mom belatedly establishing boundaries. I heard back an hour later. "Monday it is." He already annoyed me, and we hadn't even met yet. I would soon learn a lesson men have known for years, that it's possible to be attracted to somebody you don't like. Maybe "like" is the wrong word. There was something clumsily endearing about him. Or maybe it was just his looks. Even cynical women can be reduced to buttery puddles by a pretty face. He told me to meet him at his subway stop in Brooklyn. He was shorter than I expected, but otherwise very cute. I wore heels and a dress, like an adult on a date. He wore corduroys and slip-on Van sneakers. I hovered over his shaggy blonde head. He took me for a walk around his neighborhood. I'm always suspicious when a guy takes his date on a walk, because it reeks of poverty and an inability to plan. It seemed as if he was taking me on a stroll of his estate, and from the way people on the street greeted him with questions about his tour and his album, it was as if he was the king of his neighborhood. We wound up in a bar, where we sat next to each other on stools. Once I got my beer, he put his knee between my legs, and I remembered why I agreed to go out with him. I felt my contempt for his Peter Pan posturing slip away as hormones seized my body. All I could think about was how the corduroy over his knee felt between my bare thighs. He told me he bought a DVD of The Electric Company to show episodes to his son. I had told him that I was a fan of 1970s children's television. "Do you want to come over and watch The Electric Company?" he asked. I squeezed his knee with my legs. "Sure." He lived in a one-bedroom apartment and had converted the bedroom into a playroom for his little boy. It was cluttered with wooden toys and everything was at shin level. He kept this room for whenever his child came to visit him, which apparently was not very often. We retired to the living room, where dresser drawers hit a Murphy bed. His mattress lowered like a drawbridge, and we fooled around on it for a few hours. It was lovely, clumsy fun. 3 days later, I got a text message from him. "Hope you got home okay last night." Then right afterward, "Oops. Sorry, Julie. I thought I sent that text Tuesday." Thanks to technology, there are so many more ways to fail. After the fail text, I heard nothing. I feel dumb admitting it, but part of me believed that making out with me would launch him into action mode. A few weeks later, on a flight from Chicago back to New York, I couldn't sleep. I had cast myself as the lead in the pornography looping in my head. Just like Splenda can make you hungry for more sweets, even a casual sexual encounter can breed a craving for what can't be sated by a night of fumbling on a Murphy bed. I sent a text message from the baggage claim area at Kennedy Airport. He said he was cleaning. I offered to come over with my DVD of Free to Be, You and Me, on the chance he was up for some 70s children's TV, which by now I assumed was a euphemism. I took a cab over to his place, where we hung out in his kitchen listening to music and eating ravioli while he told me about his son. The custody proceedings in the last week had turned ugly. The child's mother didn't want him to have any visitation rights, and he was heartbroken. He told me they had gone out for 3 months, but he had never called her his girlfriend. When he broke up with her, she announced she was pregnant. He thought she was on the pill and figured she had gotten pregnant so he wouldn't leave. He did anyway, after which she had the baby and moved overseas. I felt bad for the woman if she thought a baby could act as a maturity miracle grow on a man who had dated her for months but still kept it casual. But I also felt bad for him, sideswiped by this unfortunate side effect of a life lived dreamily. I remember Joanna telling me how many of his songs were about longing and loss. I thought about the love of his life, this little boy with yellow hair, living a world away. He made sure to use a condom with me that night on his son's bed. Afterward, I didn't hear from him. I didn't want to call, but I realized I had left my earrings and my DVD at his apartment. I needed to get my things and move on, but I knew it was up to me. He wasn't going to get in touch with me. I was waiting for the great pumpkin to give me back my earrings. I sent him a curt text on my way to the subway, telling him that I wanted my stuff back and that I would be in his neighborhood later. In the meantime, I went to meet a friend for drinks at a bar not too far from his apartment. Hours after I sent the text message, I heard back. "Hi, Julie. So sorry I've been out of touch. Things have been crazy. The other thing is that I've started seeing somebody else and want to see where it's going. Anyway, I have your stuff. Just let me know where I can drop it off. XO." I felt my cheeks get hot. How did this happen? Even though I had seen right through this clown, I still managed to get hurt. I did like him, despite everything. It wasn't fair. Soon he entered the bar with a shopping bag and slid into the booth between my friend and me. The awkwardness was palpable, sultry like fondue. "Hi," he said, handing me the bag. "Thank you," I replied, staring at my drink. There was a long pause. "So," he said, "what are you doing?" I took in a sharp breath and looked him in the eye. "Having a drink," I said, answering the world's stupidest question. He took a moment to assess, then rose silently from the booth and slipped into the night. I took up my DVD, put my earrings on, crumpled up the shopping bag, and finished my Diet Coke.
That's Sashir Zameda, reading Julie Klausner's essay, "Was I on a Date or Babysitting?" More from Julie after the break.
I'm Julie Turkowitz. I'm a reporter at the New York Times. To understand changes in migration, I traveled to the Darien Gap. Thousands have been risking their lives to pass through the border of Colombia and Panama in the hopes of making it to the United States. We interviewed hundreds of people to try and grasp what's making them go to these lengths. New York Times journalists spend time in these places to help you understand what's really happening there. You can support this kind of journalism by subscribing to the New York Times.
We're back. It's Modern Love, the podcast. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Julie Klausner is no stranger to putting her life out there in writing. She created and co-starred in the Hulu comedy series Difficult People, where she played an aspiring comic living in New York. But she says that writing this modern love column and the book of essays she wrote about her dating life afterward made her feel more vulnerable than she ever does in her comedy.
I was terrified sharing this story with the world. I still look back and I cringe. I think there was a certain amount of, like, leaping off a diving board and hope that the pool has water in it to it. You know, I'm a comedy writer by trade, so I try to, like, put a few layers and jokes between who I am and what I do. And this essay and that book did not do that. So I feel very vulnerable and embarrassed talking about it. But as those pieces stand, I am in a mind right now to really believe that they are not for me. They're for the people reading them. They don't belong to me. They're in the world. And to have reached women that commiserated, empathized, makes me feel a lot better for having put myself out there.
Julie wants people listening to her story to understand that they're not alone.
I hope, and especially from women, that they will see themselves in this experience and give themselves the right to feel how they feel and not judge it and say, yeah, I knew this guy was probably not, you know, going to be the love of my life and we weren't going to move to Vermont and start a family and raise labradoodles, but I slept with him anyway and I was hurt when he disappeared. And that's okay. That's normal. That's actually really beautiful.
Now, over a decade later, Julie rarely thinks about the musician she wrote about in this essay. She doesn't even know if he read the piece and says she doesn't care. And when she does think about this experience,
I don't think about him. I think about me. And I try to sort of have compassion for this young, a lot thinner than me now, girl, although she didn't think so at the time. And I try to almost visualize, like, present day me, like, giving her a hug and kind of saying, like, not that this will get better as much as just this sucks and you're in it and everything you feel and think is completely okay.
Julie says that now she approaches relationships very differently.
I'm definitely less reckless when it comes to love in my late 30s now than I was in my 20s. I absolutely have the pressure of experience weighing over every decision I make. I don't have the energy to be hurt and have the confidence that I'm going to bounce back. And I'm just so very tired. So in a way, I think I'm a lot more protective of myself and my resources than I used to be.
Julie Klausner. She's a comedian and the creator of Hulu's Difficult People. She lives in New York City. After the break, Daniel Jones, editor of the Modern Love column for the New York Times, and more from Sashir Zameda.
I'm Julie Turkowitz. I'm a reporter at the New York Times. To understand changes in migration, I traveled to the Darien Gap. Thousands have been risking their lives to pass through the border of Colombia and Panama in the hopes of making it to the United States. We interviewed hundreds of people to try and grasp what's making them go to these lengths. New York Times journalists spend time in these places to help you understand what's really happening there. You can support this kind of journalism by subscribing to the New York Times.
Dan Jones says that in this piece, Julie Klausner gets at what it's like to feel a little bit superior to the person you're dating.
You protect yourself by thinking, oh, well, I don't want him. He's not right for me. He's not a grown-up. All these things are wrong, so I don't really care, and I'm just going to get out of this what I feel like getting out of it. And then she likes him anyway. And at the end, it reminded me of the Seinfeld episode where Kramer gets fired from a job that he doesn't even have. And he says, like, you can't fire me. I don't even work here. And she says, like, the equivalent of, like, you can't break up with me. I'm not even going out with you.
And Sashir Zameda says that Julie's story reminded her of her own dating life.
Well, I've definitely had silly New York flings that were hard to understand because of miscommunication or lack of communication. Just being frustrated with a guy who you're not even serious with, but you still like him because there was a physical aspect. I mean, yeah, Julie may as well have been writing one of my exploits earlier in my years living in New York.
Sasheer Zameda. Her stand-up special is called Pizza Mind, and she hosts the podcast United States of Music. Next week, Kristen Scott Thomas, who stars in the film Darkest Hour. She reads an essay about a woman who's afraid that she and her husband have nothing left to talk about.
We decided to give talking a real go. That night, we sat purposefully on the couch. We put away the computers. We silenced our ringers. We looked at each other and smiled. We sipped some red wine. What do you want to talk about? I asked. What do you want to talk about? He asked. We stared at each other.
Modern Love is a production of The New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It's produced, directed, and edited by Jessica Alpert, John Parati, Emery Sievertson, and Caitlin O'Keefe. Additional sound design by Matt Reed. The idea for the Modern Love podcast was conceived by Lisa Tobin. Iris Adler is our executive producer. Daniel Jones is the editor of Modern Love for The New York Times and advisor to the show. Music for the podcast, courtesy of APM. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. See you next week.